Support for Earth Eats comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com.
And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Kate Young.
I think a lot of people are under the impression that they can change the food system by what they buy at the grocery store.
Today on our show, we'll hear from author Ted Genoways about his book that puts consumers in touch with one farm family's challenges. Lee Bush and Maddie Chera talk with food historian Simona Chinotto, a recent visiting scholar at the Indiana University Food Institute. And Chef Daniel Orr shows us a simple way to prepare fresh mushrooms on the grill. That's all coming up on Earth Eats. The news today comes to us from Harvest Public Media. The world's largest meatpacking company, JBS, is now a little smaller. JBS announced the sale of their massive cattle feeding operation earlier this month, and as Harvest Public Media's Esther Honig reports, it's the most recent asset the Brazil-based company has sold off in the wake of a corruption scandal.
JBS agreed to pay the Brazilian government a fine of $3.2 billion last year for bribing government officials and politicians. Soon after, the company announced they'd sell three of their larger operations, including Five Rivers Cattle Feeding. Five Rivers runs several feedlots across the country, including in Colorado, Kansas, and North Texas. Pinnacle Asset Management, a New York-based firm, purchased Five Rivers for about $200 million. Pinnacle says Five Rivers will keep its management structure and still supply cattle to JBS processing plants. JBS USA CEO says the sale is a strategic move that will allow the company to focus on other products. Esther Honig, Harvest Public Media.
U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced Monday he plans to introduce a bill that will remove hemp from the list of controlled substances. That's good news for the states that have legal but limited cultivation, including Indiana.
Hemp has a minuscule amount of the psychoactive chemical in marijuana and is considered illegal by the federal government. More than half of U.S. states allow farmers to grow it as part of research pilot programs run by state agencies and local universities. Colorado hemp farmer Ryan Laughlin grows 300 acres of the crop. He says McConnell's proposal could help when it comes to gaining access to business essentials like crop insurance, low-interest government loans, and even a bank account.
Farmers live through the banking system. I mean, this is how we operate.
McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky, which has a hemp pilot program, says he wants to put regulation of hemp in states' hands. Esther Honig, Harvest Public Media.
Thanks to Harvest Public Media for those news items. Find more at harvestpublicmedia.org. Ted Genoway's latest book follows the ups and downs of farm life in eastern Nebraska. It's called This Blessed Earth, A Year in the Life of an American Family Farm. Genoway spoke with Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach last fall, just before the book's release.
Why don't we start by meeting the cast of this story? Tell me about Rick and Heidi and Megan and Kyle and why you spent a year following this farm family.
Sure. So Rick is sort of the patriarch of the family, though the land that he's farming in York County, Nebraska, is really his wife's family's land. They've been on that land since the 1870s, and so Rick's kids are the sixth generation on the land, and he's got four kids who are slowly sort of making their way back to the farm. And Megan is the first of those to come back and really spend full time on the farm. Over the course of the book, she's completing her courtship with Kyle, who's now her husband. As of now, they also have their first child, the seventh generation.
One of the trends of this latest farm downturn has been the amount of debt that farmers have taken on. USDA predicts the farm debt could reach nearly $390 billion this year, and that would be the most since the 80s farm crisis. Debt seems to be something that's always in the back of Rick Hammond's mind. Here's what he told you about it.
No matter how good it looks on a family farm, there's still a lot of stress. And when you build a farm and the ground is very expensive, well, you get into long-term debt. And so then there's always that monkey on your back that, oh, I got to produce. I got to make this work.
How has debt influenced the way that Rick Hammond runs his farm?
Well, not just Rick, but I think every farmer always has an eye on that debt and always has the farm crisis somewhere in the back of their mind. So many of the farmers who are working now, the land that they acquired came from farmers who didn't make it through the farm crisis. I'm always struck listening to the Hammonds and to anyone talk about their ground. They almost always refer to it by the name of whoever
previous farmer.
Yeah, whoever they acquired it from. And there's a kind of ghost geography that exists that the farmers see, and that always seems to be informing their decisions. They don't want somebody with a different last name to be referring to their ground as, you know, the old Hammond place.
The Hammond family they've tried some organic farming. They tried some grass-fed beef, and it didn't go all that well for them. Yeah. The kinds of practices that they might think consumers want just didn't work out the way they had hoped. So where does that leave them thinking about, you know, this relationship between consumers and farmers?
I think it's a complicated relationship, and I think the Hammonds, like many farmers, feel under scrutiny. They feel criticized by a lot of the people who ideally would be natural allies. I think one of the things that the people who are sort of the proponents of the food revolution really have failed to do and need to do going forward is listen to farmers, listen to the obstacles that they face. I think a lot of people are under the impression that they can change the food system by what they buy at the grocery store. And it's really not that simple. If they really want to change the food system, it's got to be about regulation. It's got to be about incentives that are built into the system. And for that to happen requires much broader changes than can happen just through consumer habits.
Ted Genoways wrote This Blessed Earth, A Year in the Life of an American Family Farm.
That's writer Ted Genoways talking to Grant Gerlach of NET News. Production support comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step, New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Next, we have an interview from last fall with Simone Cinotto. Dr. Cinotto was a visiting scholar at Indiana University in 2017, and he spoke with Lee Bush and Maddie Chera of the IU Food Institute.
I'm Lee Bush.
I'm Maddie Chera.
And today we're here with Dr. Simone Cinotto, Associate Professor of Modern History at the University of Gastronomic Sciences in Polenzo. Dr. Cinotto is a visiting professor at Collins Living Learning Center at Indiana University this year.
My permanent job is in Italy. I work for this university called, in Italian, Università di Scienze Gastronomiche, which I think translates best in the University of Food Studies. This is what we do. Is a This is a kind of model that there is a little bit emerging, I would say, in Europe, of so-called quote-unquote thematic universities, meaning entirely devoted to a field. In this case, this very multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary field, which is food studies.
And he's been up to some pretty interesting projects with the students.
My course is called The History of Culture of Italian Food. And I cover basically the time since Italy unification 1861 to now. But now we are approaching basically the transformation of the Italian diet, the Italian food system right after World War II, when Italy, by the mid-1950s, experienced the so-called Italian miracle, or the Italian economic boom. And basically, is when basically happened the so-called rural flight. I mean, agriculture was industrialized, mm-hmm. basically as part of the broader transformation of the Green Revolution worldwide.
Right.
So it became strictly, you know, market-oriented economy and so on and so forth. So basically, the countryside depopulated. Most of the people went to the cities to become factory workers.
The University of Gastronomic Sciences is located in Palenzo, in northwestern Italy. This is where the slow food movement originated. It all started in Italy. And the president of the university, Carlo Petrini, is the founder of the slow food movement. Chera and Bush wanted to know if the slow food movement would come up in Cinotto's course at IU.
We're going to talk about slow food and basically the third stage in the history of food, of the Italian food, the food in Italy, which is the new culture of food that, for the most part, try to recover in a postmodern way older traditions, knowledges.
Some of those things lost after the World War II Green Revolution.
Exactly. From the very beginning, I think that the idea was to export that model elsewhere. And in the first place, I would say in the United States, which were supposed to be, you know, the enemy, but not because not the American people was the enemy, but it was, you know, this industrial complex and the way it expanded outside the U.S. It was here threatening. But, you know, basically the same model of defending, promoting, valorizing the work of farmers, rediscovering and engaging consumers in being interested in, you know, local breeds, you know, seeds, everything, was very much re-exported to the United States and the rest of the world. Basically, there are two souls a little bit in slow food. One is the more gourmet dimension. I mean, loving the preparations, loving the products, loving the convivial moments, and then there's the more, you know, openly political activist dimension, mm-hmm. Which about, you know, food justice, food sovereignty, combating hunger. For the most part, these two dimensions, if you ask me, they should, you know, they should really mingle, you know,
right.
not being some separated. But no, so again, I think what I'm doing, I hope not to be too boring for them, because I you know, they're fresh out of high school,
right.
They barely know where Italy is, and I'm not blaming them. I mean, it's, you know, it's completely fine. So I have to provide a lot of contextualization. But when I get to the actual topic of food, I see that they're responding, oh, like, you know, I guess that food was so important for, you know, the entire human experience. Now I can see the connection, and maybe they can take it from there and expand it a little more. So there is a practical side to the course. Basically, every Monday night at the Food Institute, we cook an Italian meal. And I want them to expose them to some of the very basic practice of Italian cooking. So to give you an idea, the first The first time we had the gnocchi, which is the potato dumpling, and the appetizer was the polpette di melanzane, which is eggplant meatball, so meatless meatball made of eggplant. That was very, very successful with a heart of provolone cheese. So when you crack the meatball with no meat, there is this melted cheese, little spice inside, and
yes, please.
So potato gnocchi the first time. Let me see. Lasagna the second Monday, and with different kind of stuffing. Also, I wanted to understand that Italian cooking is very popular. But I would say a perfect example is pasta. It's a very much malleable and flexible material that you can turn with your creativity, but not too much creativity, because this is another part. Anyway, and ingenuity, you can really shape basically, innumerable ways. So the way you sauce it and the different shapes of pasta itself, which for the most part reflect the different local food patterns and food ways of Italy. This is just an example.
Wow.
And so supposedly there is this code for Italians where, you know, a certain pasta shapes goes well with a certain sauce or a limited number of sauces. But anyway, it's like, you have the entire palette of possibilities with a single, basically, material that you can shape and reshape in different ways. This is the idea that I also try to provide. So first with gnocchi, then lasagna, then ravioli and tortelli, which is, as you know, the filled pasta.
Right.
Again, the filling can be everything from meat, pumpkin, squash, artichokes, whatever.
So
cheese,
you guys are cranking out fresh pasta every week.
Fresh pasta,
really?
Yeah.
We gotta get over there.
I had the Food Institute invest in the pasta machine.
Oh, nice.
Manual.
I think $30. Yes. Very good. By the way, lasagna, ravioli, risotto. We did the, which is this particular way of Italian way of preparing rice, which is not boiled for the most part, but simmers in vegetable or whatever stock you want to use. And then next time would be polenta, which is this very poor dish that fed northern Italians, northern central Italian, for almost three centuries. Corn and cornmeal are a great example of how food history worked. I mean, it became the staple food, for northern rural Italians, but it is an American plant originating in Latin America. Mm. Of course,
mm-hmm.
Arrived in Europe as part of the so-called Colombian exchange, and it remained basically a botanical oddity for, at least in Italy, for more than two centuries. So polenta, which is basically the cornmeal, and also gnocchi alla romana, which is, I don't know if you ever heard of it. Anyway, it's a very, very, again, easy but kind of delicious preparation. Is basically made of durum wet semolina mixed with eggs, mm-hmm. a little bit of eggs, rolled in a cylinder that could cut in discs that are again sauced with butter and Parmesan cheese, and then baked in the oven. Some sage leaves. It's pretty simple, very simple, but kind of. I fed my children with that a lot because it's easy to do and kind of satisfying.
Yeah.
While they could have easily talked ravioli and gnocchi for the rest of the day, it was time to say goodbye to Dr. Cinotto.
I hope the rest of your semester goes tastefully well.
Thanks. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
We have links to information about Cinotto's work, Slow Food, and the University of Gastronomic Sciences in Italy. You'll find it all at eartheats.org. The first of the spring mushrooms should be showing up on forest floors across the Midwest. And with warmer weather in sight, it might be time to break out the grill. Chef Daniel Orr has a delightfully simple recipe for fresh mushrooms on the grill. He got his mushrooms directly from a local grower. Let's hear what he does with them.
So this is a new product that Darren from Good Life Farms is doing. And he does a lot of the greens and herbs and things for the restaurants and farmers markets around town. But he just started doing this new mushroom that's called a blue oyster. So you remember the band Blue Oyster Cult?
Vaguely.
We might be doing a Blue Oyster Cult brochette or something today. And then he also is doing cremini. He's been doing the cremini, which are kind of like a gourmet button mushroom, for a while. And a cremini is actually a baby portobello. So when the cremini grows up, it turns into a portobello. We also have some of his arugula here. And here are a couple of the creminis. And you can see how fresh they are. Very light brown cap. When you're picking out mushrooms, you want to look at the cut end of the stem, and they should be the same color as the outside of the stem. But generally, in most supermarkets, you'll find that they're discolored and brown. But you can see these were just harvested within the last day or two. Wonderful things. And these are huge. So I'm going to cut these in half, and we'll make some brochettes out of them.
We'll have all the details for this recipe on our website, eartheats.org.
All right, so what we're going to do with these local mushrooms is we're going to make a brochette. Brochette is basically a skewer. And what we've done is we've got these skewers. They're wooden skewers. They're about, 8 to 10 inches long. And what I've done is I've soaked them in water. Now, that's an important thing to do because we're going to be throwing them on the grill. And you'll find out that a lot of times when you do brochettes, if they're not completely covered with mushrooms or vegetables or meat, they're going to burn, and then it kind of loses the whole reason to have a brochette, which is to make a nice little skewer. So when you soak them in water, that prevents them from burning during the cooking process. Now what we're going to do is we're going to take some of those nice big cremini mushrooms, cut them in half, and set them aside. Okay, and then I've got the blue oysters. And these we're going to cut into chunks from the stem side so that they still stay together in like little mini groupings of mushrooms. And then we take the wet skewer, and I'm going to put them on one by one. And I want to have the cut side down on the creminis. And I'm going to vary them back and forth. Then what I'm going to do is I'm going to put a little bit of olive oil, just a little bit. You don't want to put too much oil on anything you grill because you'll tend to have flare-ups, which will actually burn and create this kind of dark smoke that makes your food taste bad. So when you're making a marinade, even if it's for meat or chicken or fish, you want to use very little oil and get most of it off of there during the cooking process. Now I'm going to season. Just real simple, and again, you know, this is our old Earth Eats saying, it's 90% buying good products and 10% not messing up what you bought. So we're just going to put a little bit of salt and pepper on both sides, and then we're going to take it to the grill. Now, if you don't have a grill, you could also do this under the broiler, which would be just fine. So if you don't have a grill, that doesn't mean you can't make this recipe. And you don't have to use these two kinds of mushrooms. You could use any type of mushroom you could find. You could use chicken of the woods mushrooms. You could use, I would say morels probably wouldn't work that well because they shrink up a lot. But any kind of steaky, meaty mushroom, portobellos you could use. And you could just use portobellos. You don't have to use a whole variety of mushrooms. Now the other thing I'm going to do is I've got a hot pan on the grill, and I'm going to just flip that over the top. And what that will do is that will cook the mushrooms from both sides. And since it's already hot, it's going to sear, and it's going to keep that heat kind of like a convection oven going around those mushrooms and cooking it. And you can do this with, you know, burgers or salmon steaks or anything. So it's really a good technique to have in your back pocket when you're using the grill.
And is that a it looks like it might be a cast iron pan.
Yeah, well, we call these in the restaurant, we call them sizzler platters. Yeah, it's kind of like a fajita platter, actually. You know, like you might find in a Mexican restaurant.
But the key is to have it hot before, have it on the grill.
It should have some weight to it. It shouldn't just be like an aluminum piece, because then that's not really going to do the same thing. You want it to have some, you know, some good solid metal.
That makes sense.
Okay, one of the keys to this is you don't want to overcook your mushrooms. If you overcook them, their mushrooms are about 85% water. So when you're cooking them, you're just dehydrating them and you're cooking out the moisture. So that's why you want to use a really hard heat to sear them in, keep that moisture inside, and you don't want to cook them too long. Let's move these back over to the other side and we'll put a plate together. So you can hear that kind of fajita sizzle to them. Okay, I've got some roasted tomatoes. I'm going to just throw those on the platter with that so they warm up a little bit. Then Darren at Good Life Farms also does this wonderful arugula. And this is does hydroponically. So I'm just going to bunch up a little bit of that in the middle of the plate. I like to use white plates because they almost become frames around your food. And they really allow the food to be the center and the kind of the star of the dish. Then I'm going to take some truffle aioli, which is a fancy name for truffle mayonnaise. And what we do with this is we take some mayonnaise and we add some red onions, some thyme, rosemary, truffle oil, lemon juice, lemon zest, and some roasted garlic to that. And that makes the truffle aioli. And we're just putting that on as a dressing. Then I'll lift up that skewer, put that on there. So it's almost like a warm salad. We're finished putting these nice roasted tomatoes. And then finally, but not least importantly, we're going to finish with a little bit of fresh lemon juice. Anytime you pull something off the grill, I like to squeeze a little fresh lemon juice on it. I think it accentuates that kind of grilled flavor, gives it a little bit of a zip, and it needs to be fresh. Don't be buying bottled lemon juice. And so that is our brochette of local mushrooms with Darren's arugula and a wonderful truffle herb aioli.
The grilled mushrooms on that brilliant green bed of tender arugula really does make a stunning plate. Accented by the deep red of the roasted tomato, wow. But don't take my word for it. Check out the photos at eartheats.org. Be sure to look for us on Twitter, at eartheats. Support comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services. Assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows. Helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Thank you, thank you, thank you to everyone who makes Earth Eats possible. That includes Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, Farm Bloomington Restaurant, Indiana University Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Maddie Chera, Lee Bush, and Simone Cinotto. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young, and that's our show. Thanks for listening to Earth Eats.